Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 17th, 2023 issue of the Week. On the cover drawing of this issue, we have Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He's got a tough guy look on his face, and in his left hand, he's holding a short club and pounding it into his right hand. In front of him are three characters sitting in chairs facing away from him. They're tied to the chairs and have duct tape over their mouths. In the middle is the Disney character Mickey Mouse. On one side of him is a middle-aged man, looks like he's a reporter, and on the other side is a young woman, looks like a school teacher. The headline is "The Speech Police: DeSantis Escalating War on the Press, Woke Corporations, LGBTQ, and Educators." And I believe we get that as the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. At CPAC, Trump promises retribution. What happened? Donald Trump showed his enduring grip on the Republican Party's populist base at the Conservative Political Action Conference last weekend, dominating the annual gathering with an ominous keynote speech in which he vowed to get revenge for Americans who have been wronged and betrayed by liberal and Republican elites. "I am your warrior," he told them. "I am your justice. I am your retribution." Once a magnet for GOP leaders and presidential contenders, this year's CPAC was sparsely attended and shunned by many prominent Republicans, including presidential hopefuls Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Speakers included Donald Trump Jr., his girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoyle, and Trump's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump. And vendors did a brisk business in Trump bobbleheads and T-shirts depicting Trump as the Terminator and Superman. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley tried to make a case for her presidential candidacy, but was heckled by Trump supporters. She drew only 3% in a straw poll of attendees that Trump won handily, taking 62% to DeSantis, 20%. In Trump's 90-minute speech, he said the U.S. is becoming a crime-ridden, filthy communist nightmare, and cast himself as the Republican's sole hope in an epic battle against sinister forces. He vowed not to drop out of the race if he is indicted in any of the numerous investigations he faces, and refused to say whether he'll sign a pledge to back the GOP nominee if he loses the primary. "There are probably people that I wouldn't be very happy about endorsing," he said. What the columnist said: Trump's speech was filled with echoes of the very worst movements that modern humankind has produced, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The promise to avenge his followers' humiliation by sinister forces came straight from the playbooks of Mussolini and Hitler. Trumpism can be fairly called the F word, fascism. He even vowed to send National Guard troops into cities to lock up criminals and restore order. This CPAC was full of flashing sirens for American democracy. Trump's promise to deliver retribution is admittedly horrifying, said Rod Dreher in the American Conservative, but the left needs to ask itself why he remains so popular among millions of Americans. Maybe it's that they resent seeing migrants pour across our borders, communities riddled with drugs and crime, the loss of middle-class jobs, and a woke ruling class that discriminates against whites for their skin color and teaches children to hate their own bodies and think that they might be happy if they severed their breast or testicles. Given the carnival atmosphere and the parade of loons like Mike MyPillow Lindell, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. It's easy to dismiss CPAC as mere fodder for late-night comedians, but we laugh at our peril. Republican voters cheered as Lindell claimed 10 million Trump ballots were stolen. Columnist Gordon Chang asserted that China spread COVID on purpose. And Daily Wire host Michael Knowles called for transgenderism to be eradicated from public life. What if treating Trump and those far-right wingnuts as a joke just repeats the mistake that many political observers made in 2016? CPAC might be Trump's high watermark rather than his launch pad, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. Yes, he romped in the straw poll of a crowd of hardcore Trumpers, but past CPAC poll winners have included Jack Kemp, Phil Graham, Rand Paul, and Ron Paul. So it would be a mistake to read much into this poll. In his speech and a campaign video, Trump sounded desperate and made bizarre promises like building futuristic freedom cities on federal land and making America the leader in developing flying cars. That will give DeSantis a lot of targets to shoot at. Still, Trump remains the GOP's clear front-runner, said Joe Walsh in The Bulwark. The Trump devotees who throng CPAC and its boiling cauldron of batshit crazy stew are not a loony far-right fringe of the GOP. They are the party, and they could care less that he ended his first term with an attempted coup. If it wasn't clear before, it should be clear now. The voting base of one of our two major political parties is completely radicalized. And a second shorter main story. Ukraine grinds away at Wagner Group in Bakhmut. What happened? The battle for Bakhmut intensified this week as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed not to withdraw his troops, even after Russia's paramilitary Wagner Group claimed control of the city's east. The small salt mining city has been the focus of Russia's offensive for months, and Russian forces now surround it on three sides. Wagner Group commanders have been sending in waves of unseasoned prison recruits, knowing they will be mowed down by Ukrainian artillery, so the commanders can see the locations of the Ukrainian guns and launch targeted attacks. The carnage has been immense. Russia has lost an estimated 30,000 soldiers in Bakhmut, seven times the Ukrainian casualties. And Ukrainians say they've seen Russians reduced to fighting in hand-to-hand combat, armed only with shovels. While some Western military analysts have suggested that Ukraine should abandon the town and devote its resources to preparing for a southern counteroffensive, Ukrainian commanders said the continuing to fight in Bakhmut was key to depleting Russia's forces. This is their last stand, Colonel Serhiy Cherevaty told Radio Liberty. A grainy 12-second video showing what happened to be a machine gun execution by Russian forces of a Ukrainian soldier circulated widely on social media this week. The Ukrainian military said it believed the man was a soldier with the 30th Mechanized Brigade who had been fighting near Bakhmut and went missing last month. Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba asked the International Criminal Court to investigate the incident, calling it another piece of proof this war is genocidal. What the columnist said. Bakhmut has come to symbolize the grinding war of attrition in Ukraine, said Claire Parker in the Washington Post. While the city is not strategically important, it has gained outsized political importance for both sides, simply because the fighting has been so intense. Wagner Group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin is using the battle there as a showpiece as he jockeys with Russia's military chiefs for influence. And for Ukrainians, Bakhmut is a rallying cry. The executed soldier in the video has become another icon of defiance, said Kathy Young in The Bulwark. The clip shows him standing in a shallow trench, looking exhausted but calmly smoking a cigarette. Showing little emotion, he calls out the national salute, Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine, just before off-camera Russians curse at him and release a burst of automatic gunfire. With his image already appearing on posters and murals, his senseless killing will almost certainly make Ukrainians more determined to win. Unfortunately, the Biden administration is helping to prolong the war through its reluctance to send Ukraine advanced weaponry, said Matthew Continetti in National Review. With no decisive Ukrainian advances in months, U.S. public support for aid to Ukraine is slipping. The administration needs a victory strategy now, and that should include invoking the Defense Production Act and ramping up defense spending. Ukraine is the central front in the fight for freedom, and it's in America's interest to give Zelensky all he needs and when he asks for it. And the controversy of the week, DeSantis escalating the war on free speech. The weather may be better, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, but Florida is about to start looking a lot like Hungary. Viktor Orban, Hungary's far-right strongman prime minister, has become a hero on the American far-right for seizing control of schools and colleges, the media, and the courts to promote traditional Christian values and defeat cultural liberalism. No American politician is imitating Orban as faithfully as the Florida governor and likely Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis. As he ramps up a run for the GOP presidential nomination, DeSantis is gleefully using government power to control the state's schools, universities, and corporations, and to wage war on free speech. His allies in Florida's legislature recently unveiled a shocking new raft of bills that would ban Florida universities from offering majors in gender studies, teaching American history with a focus on slavery and racism, or sharing unproven, theoretical, or exploratory content, a phrase as purposefully vague as the ban on inappropriate books that has already emptied library shelves in Florida's K-12 schools. The comparison to Orban's authoritarianism is not hyperbole, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. To punish Disney for criticizing his Don't Say Gay law, DeSantis last week appointed a board of far-right ideologues to oversee the special district for Disney's Orlando theme park. Among them is conservative Christian minister Ron Perry, who claims that estrogen is the water from birth control pills, is turning men gray. Disney's new overseers, DeSantis warned, very much would like to see the type of entertainment that all families can appreciate. Or else. It gets worse, says Kate Ruane in USA Today. DeSantis is backing another proposed Florida law that would radically change the defamation protections underpinning press freedom in America. If enacted, public figures could sue journalists for libel for exposing their affairs or personal crimes, and information obtained by anonymous sources would be considered presumptively false. Publicly accusing a religious person like Perry of bigotry or discrimination, meanwhile, would automatically count as defamation. If the law sounds unconstitutional, its backers are counting on that, said the New York Times in an editorial. His cronies hope this sledgehammer bill will reach the Supreme Court, giving ultra-conservative justices a chance to rein in a news industry they consider to be too liberal. Wait, don't conservatives want more speech? Asked Fabio Bertoni in The New Yorker. What DeSantis is doing in Florida directly contradicts the complaints of Republicans that free speech is under assault from big tech and the woke mob. If DeSantis succeeds in lowering libel standards, said Anthony L. Fisher in the Daily Beast, his own right-wing media buddies would probably suffer the harshest consequences. It's the U.S.'s robust protections for media freedom that lets Fox News feed its viewers misinformation and bogus conspiracy theories. Clearly, our country is in big trouble, said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark. Polls show that 75% of GOP voters want either Trump or DeSantis as their next president, which means one of our two major parties yearns to renegotiate the foundations of our governing compact. In 2024, the First Amendment, personal liberty, and democracy itself may be on the ballot. When the choice is between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, we've already strayed way, way outside the American political tradition. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for suing Elon Musk after the Twitter CEO mocked fired employee Haraldur Thorleifsson, saying he used his muscular dystrophy as an excuse for why he did no actual work. After Thorleifsson explained how the worsening disability had affected his ability to type, Musk apologized and offered him his job back. It was a good week for DIY titles after Prince Harry and Meghan Markle unilaterally awarded their 2-year-old daughter a royal title at her christening, calling her Princess Lilibet Diana. The royal family had no comment. And it was a good week for a glimpse of the truth. After a newly revealed text in the Dominion lawsuit against Fox News showed Tucker Carlson saying in 2021 he hoped to soon ignore Donald Trump, adding, "I hate him passionately." But it was a bad week for useful idiots after Fox News' Sean Hannity aired an interview in which Donald Trump claimed he would have prevented the war in Ukraine by negotiating a peace deal. Edited out was Trump's admission he would have let Russia take over parts of Ukraine. It was a bad week for abstinence after UCLA researchers found that participation in the online NoFap movement, which urges young men to pledge to refrain from masturbation, can instead lead to anxiety, depression, and shame when they inevitably give in. And finally, it was a bad week for Representative George Santos, who was the target of a new bill, the No Fortune for Fraud Act. Representatives indicted or convicted of fraud would be barred from making money from a book deal, a TV movie, Dancing with the Stars, or the next Netflix special, said co-sponsor Representative Anthony D. Esposito, Republican from New York. Briefing this week, regulating the rails. The freight rail industry is facing major safety questions after a hazardous waste spill in East Palestine, Ohio. How large is the rail industry? Almost half of all intercity freight transportation and one-third of U.S. exports moved by rail. Over 140,000 miles of privately owned tracks crisscrossing every state except Hawaii. Trains transport more than two-thirds of shipments of coal and a major portion of grain, cars, and chemicals. About 4.5 million tons of toxic chemicals are moved by train every year. Every day, an average of 12,000 rail cars carry hazardous materials through American towns and cities, including major cities with a lot of traffic to Pittsburgh, Houston, and Detroit. An estimated 25 million people live in an oil train blast zone, the one-mile evacuation zone in case of an oil fire. The industry is largely controlled by seven rail corporations that own or operate nearly all of the country's long-distance tracks, down from 63 Class I railroad companies 50 years ago. In the West, Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe control the routes, while in the East, it's CSX and Norfolk Southern, the company responsible for the East Palestine incident. Kansas City Southern, Canadian National, and Canadian Pacific traverse the country north to south. Was the East Palestine derailment an anomaly? The size of the spill and subsequent burn-off received an unusual amount of attention, but derailments occur almost every day. Another Norfolk Southern derailed in Ohio last week, and a train carrying 30,000 gallons of propane derailed in Florida. Neither caused a spill. From 1990 to 2021, the Bureau of Transportation Statistics recorded about 54,500 incidents, an average of 1,704 annually, with about 5,500 injuries. Most derailments are minor, with no damage to cars, and overall the number of them is declining, although Norfolk Southern's accident rate is climbing. Over those 31 years, 131 people, or four per year, died as a direct result of derailments. Trucks, which transport the largest percentage of hazardous materials, actually cause far more injuries and deaths. When are accidents dangerous? When derailed trains are carrying hazardous materials, as in East Palestine. After that derailment, caused when one car's wheel bearings overheated and burst into flame, Norfolk Southern conducted a controlled burn-off of 1.6 million pounds of vinyl chloride and other toxic chemicals, raising serious ongoing concerns among residents about possible health impacts. In 2022, hazardous materials were released in about 10 train incidents. Pittsburgh may be particularly vulnerable. Up to half of the Bakken shale oil refined on the East Coast passes through the city, and in the past 5 years, eight trains have derailed in the region, with about 176,000 people living in the one-mile blast zone. The railroads are playing Russian roulette with Pittsburgh, said Glenn Olcrest, founder of the advocacy group Rail Pollution Protection Pittsburgh. We are a prime candidate for a major derailment and explosion. Is the industry heavily regulated? Thanks to industry lobbying, companies are free to make many of their own safety decisions. In the past 2 decades, the four largest railroads and their trade associations spent more than $480 million on federal lobbying. In 2017, the Trump administration reversed an Obama-era regulation mandating that trains carrying explosive liquids adopt an electronic braking system, which sends signal to brake to every car at the same time. Most trains rely instead on a Civil War-era braking system that passes the signal through the train one car at a time and can take 2 minutes to stop a long train. Today's 150-car trains are about 9,000 feet long, more than double the average length in 2017. What role do train workers play? A diminished one. Since 2016, rail companies have eliminated almost 60,000 jobs through automation. Under current union rules, there is no federal requirement. Most trains have only two workers to monitor trains that stretch for more than a mile. Railroads hope to reduce that to one worker, just the engineer, which the unions say would be dangerous. The industry has also exerted influence on rules about labeling dangerous materials. the highly flammable materials in the East Palestine incident, for example, didn't meet the official definition of a high-hazard flammable train. In 2020, the Department of Transportation began allowing highly explosive liquefied natural gas to be shipped by freight trains without additional safety controls. The Palestine wreck is the tip of the iceberg and a red flag, said Ron Kamenkow, a former Norfolk Southern engineer. If something is not done, it's going to get worse, and the next derailment could be cataclysmic. What's the industry's defense? It denies that it skimps on safety and points to the overall decline in derailments. The rail companies insist they can ensure safety by relying on automated systems that scan cars and tracks for problems as trains are in motion. But cost cutting is not without risk. From 2016 to 2021, government inspectors found almost 13,000 violations relating to hazardous materials, up about 33% from the previous 5 years. In 2015, Norfolk Southern President James Squires told investors, "We believe that the new braking systems are unjustified from a cost-benefit perspective." Time for a few of the best columns of the week, starting with one from Noah Rothman of the National Review. The lesson in Lightfoot's loss. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot will leave the scene with one historic achievement, said Noah Rothman. She became the first incumbent mayor in 40 years to lose re-election in Chicago, which is dominated by the Democratic machine. When Lightfoot took office 4 years ago, she was celebrated as the city's first black woman and first gay mayor. But in last week's Democratic primary, she finished third with 17%, failing even to secure enough votes to advance to a runoff election. Why? Homicides and crime surged in 20 and 2021, yet arrest rates fell off a cliff as police feuded with Lightfoot and pulled back on enforcement. With street shootings, robberies, and burglaries soaring, many corporations fled Chicago, including Boeing, Tyson Foods, and Citadel. Rampant, organized looting in broad daylight forced Macy's, Banana Republic, and The Gap to shutter stores on the Magnificent Mile. Chicago's teachers' union refused to return to schools until January 2022, and the city's children suffered historic drops in math and reading scores, with about a fifth of high school students reading at grade level. In defeat, Lightfoot said she'd been treated unfairly because of her race and gender, but it's her record that did her in. This column comes from Italy. How many more migrants will drown? Dozens of people are dead because Italian authorities chose to treat a desperate boat full of migrants as a security threat rather than a rescue operation, said Carlo Bonini. The migrant boat that capsized last month just off the Calabrian coast carried nearly 200 men, women, and children, and only about 80 of them survived. These families, many of them Afghans fleeing the brutality of the Taliban regime, were sentenced to death by a security bureaucracy that is turning the Mediterranean Sea into a cemetery. Italian authorities working for Frontex, the European Union's border security agency, bureaucratically baptized the vessel as unrecognized and then decided it was safely above the waterline. When they did deploy rescue craft, their boats could not handle the stormy conditions and had to retreat. No one even thought of sending two larger vessels that the Italian Coast Guard had at its disposal. Italy's right-wing interior minister, Matteo Piantedosi, has tried to shift blame onto what he calls the irresponsibility of the victims for their decision to attempt the journey from Turkey in bad weather, as if the voyage were a risky cruise by wealthy yachtsmen. Isn't a sea rescue always supposed to be the responsibility of the state? Woe to the shipwrecked, because this Italy led by the ultra-right will have no mercy on them. This column is from Turkey. The glorious heritage lost to the quakes. The earthquakes that struck Turkey and Syria last month not only destroyed thousands of lives, said Justin Morosi, but also devastated the region's rich architectural heritage. The monuments and mosques damaged include precious examples of Roman, Byzantine, and Ottoman history. And while the loss of life is always felt most deeply, the loss of cultural patrimony also leaves deep wounds. The 2,000-year-old castle from Roman times that once loomed magnificently over Turkish city of Gaziantep now lies in ruins, and so does the 17th-century Cervani Mosque nearby. At least half of Antakya, the ancient city once known as Antioch, was destroyed, while in Diyarbakir, another UNESCO World Heritage Site, many buildings collapsed. Perhaps it shouldn't be a shock. Modern Turkey can't build earthquake-resistant buildings to keep its residents safe, after all, much less shore up its ancient monuments. And with Syria racked by war, architectural conservation there seems a quaint irrelevance. Turkey is used to rebuilding, of course. The Yeni Mosque in Malatya rose from the rubble twice after earthquakes in 1894 and 1964. Still, the sight of all these new ruins is a sad reminder that life in this region is always vulnerable to the next trembler. And we're on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, "The Man Who Dug Up a Nuclear Bomb." When a B-52 crashed in North Carolina, the military turned to Jack Revelle to recover its payload, said Jeremy Markovich in his NC Rabbit Hole Substack. His heroism stayed classified for decades. On a cold, wet day in January 1961, Lieutenant Jack Revelle climbed out of a muddy hole in the ground, holding a rough gray sphere the size of a volleyball against his chest. For the better part of a week, he and his crew had been digging in the swampy ground outside of Goldsboro, North Carolina. It had been raining and snowing, and the hole had grown to be larger than a football field. Jack was just 25 years old, but he was in charge. When he and his men finally found what they were looking for, Jack was the one who got to climb up the ladder and bring it out. Almost immediately, Jack flew back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. He landed in the late afternoon and went to bed early. The next morning, he took a shower, sat down at a table in his apartment, and started to write a letter to his parents, who hadn't heard from him for more than a week. It was only then that the magnitude of what he'd done started to set in. His hand started to shake. Lieutenant Jack Revelle had just located and defused two nuclear bombs that accidentally fell out of a B-52 bomber over eastern North Carolina. It sounds like hyperbole, but the story of the Goldsboro Broken Arrow has now been well documented. Over the past decade, more and more of it has been declassified, thanks in large part to the work of an Air Force veteran named Joel Dobson of Greensboro, who first heard the story years ago and just knew he had to write a book about it. I talked to Joel in 2018, and he put me in touch with Jack. Over the course of a few days, our conversation veered from the incredible to the personal, and it left me thinking about the consequences of life and the steady approach of death in a way that has stayed with me ever since. The volleyball-sized orb that he'd carried out of the muddy pit in 1961 was the primary core of a hydrogen bomb, with enough uranium and plutonium inside to create a huge crater, kill tens of thousands of people instantly, and leave parts of eastern North Carolina permanently uninhabitable. The only protection the Air Force gave Jack Revelle was his military fatigues and a pair of gloves. He held the most radioactive part of the most powerful weapon in the world had ever seen up against his chest for 15 minutes. Then, for decades, he couldn't tell anybody exactly what he'd done, not even his wife. On the night of January 23, 1961, a B-52 bomber radioed back to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro with a problem. It had a fuel leak in one of its wings. As it was coming back in for landing, the wing broke off. Five of the eight men on board were able to bail out, including Lieutenant Adam Maddox, who's believed to be the only person to escape from a crashing B-52 bomber without using an ejector seat. Maddox died in 2018. As the plane fell from the sky, it started to break apart, and two thermonuclear bombs on board fell out. In the chaos, several systems on the bombs activated themselves. On one, the parachute deployed, and it drifted down gently to the ground, coming to rest against a tree. The other one slammed into the ground at 700 miles per hour, not far from the fiery wreckage of the plane. Maddox, banged up and without his military ID, got himself to an Air Force base. He told the airmen at the front gate that a B-52 had crashed, but the word hadn't spread to them yet. Maddox, a black man, couldn't prove who he was, so the airmen arrested him for stealing government property. Shortly afterward, another pilot who recognized Maddox from flight school vouched for him. Maddox was released, and the details led to the Air Force to the crash site. That's when Lieutenant Jack Revelle got the call, got on a plane in Dayton, Ohio, with the rest of his explosive ordnance disposal team, and flew to North Carolina. Once Jack got there, he quickly rolled up on the bomb, leaning against the tree, rendered it safe, and had it loaded on the back of a flatbed truck headed for Texas. It was then that he learned there was a second bomb, somewhere beneath a farm field nearby that was strewn with wreckage. Jack asked for a long wooden stick like a broom handle to poke into the wet ground. The reason, he didn't want to touch metal with metal and cause a spark that might cause an explosion. So someone fetched a wooden rod from the back of a truck cab, and Revelle started feeling around in the muck. Quickly, he knew there was debris down there. After that, he called in the heavy excavators. The shovels didn't dig too far down before they hit the shallow water table, which meant water constantly needed to be pumped out of the hole. Jack's crew finally found the explosive part of the bomb, as well as some of the systems that would have armed it. On the eighth day, Jack fished it all out of the muddy water at the bottom of the pit. One of his sergeants found another crucial piece. "Lieutenant, we found the arm safe switch," he told Jack. "Great," Jack said. "Not great," the sergeant replied. "It's on arm." There's far from a consensus on how close those bombs were to going off. Jack himself couldn't say. But had one of them exploded, the other one would have as well. Each bomb was 250 times more powerful than the ones that decimated Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and an explosion that large would have permanently altered the geography of the state. There would have been a 17-mile-wide kill zone around the blast site. Heavy fallout would have spread as far north as New York. For years, the most harrowing information was kept a secret, and Jack himself couldn't talk about the details of his involvement. It wasn't until Joel Dobson called him in 2011 that he realized that documents about the incident had been declassified. It was then that Jack turned to his wife and shared with her the details about what he'd done in North Carolina. Years ago, on the phone from California, Jack Revelle told me he was crazy as a 25-year-old. He drove a 1959 MGA convertible with a car phone in it, so he'd be reachable in case of a nuclear accident. I asked him if the car phone was impressive whenever he went on dates. "That goes without saying," he told me. He later met his wife, Brenda, on a computer dating service. In the late 1960s, Jack was different from the other guys she'd met through that service. "He was always an upfront, honest guy," she says. Jack had been in the ROTC when he was at Purdue University. After he graduated with a degree in chemical engineering, he joined the Air Force and became an officer. While he was stationed in Japan, he heard about the Explosive Ordnance Disposal, EOD, unit, thought it was interesting, went through 6 months of training in Dayton, and then got the job. Jack earned the Bronze Star during the Vietnam War, where he was exposed to Agent Orange. He also earned the Joint Service Commendation Medal for his work with the Defense Nuclear Agency and was promoted to major. But after 11 years in the Air Force, Jack was ready to move on. In 1969, he was honorably discharged, then earned a PhD in industrial engineer and management from Oklahoma State University. He made a home in Orange County, California. Until 12 years ago, he never publicly talked about what he'd done in North Carolina. Then Joel Dobson called, interviewed him, and brought him back to the site of the accident. Jack hadn't been there in 50 years, but he recognized the tree where the first bomb had once been leaning. That moment made the hairs on the back of Joel's neck stand up. Jack started telling others about disarming the bombs. He spoke to groups around the country, including at East Carolina University in 2013. "As I carried it up out of that hole," he said of carrying the radioactive sphere, "I remember thinking, don't drop it." But by then, Jack had already started to get sick. A few years before, his doctor thought he had anemia. That didn't make sense to Jack, who'd always thought of himself as a healthy, high-energy guy. But the doctor confirmed it, then sent him off for further blood test. Those tests led to his doctors to diagnose him with myeloplastic syndrome, MDS, a precursor to leukemia. Those same doctors also told him they felt that the disease was likely caused by Jack's exposure to radiation. After the story was declassified and Jack had his diagnosis, he set out to do two things. The first, to seek official recognition for himself and his men for what they'd done in Goldsboro. The story was out, but the Air Force denied any further recognition or honors, saying that the men were simply doing the job they'd been assigned to do. In 2014, the Veterans Administration had also denied him further insurance coverage to pay for his treatment because, in their words, there was no direct connection between his exposure to radiation and his sickness. "That didn't seem right," Jack told me. "According to all the literature that I have read, the MDS that I have shows itself approximately 50 to 60 years following the radiation exposure," he said. I tried to follow up on a story he told me about a picture that he'd been trying to find for years. Back around 2000, when his story was still classified, Jack was speaking at the Sandia National Laboratories, a government-affiliated facility in New Mexico that performs nuclear research. During some free time, he wandered into a museum that was holding an exhibit about broken arrows, the military code name for the nuclear mishaps. When he came upon a display about Goldsboro, he froze. There, on the wall, was a picture of Jack climbing up a ladder with the core of the weapon against his chest. "I felt like I was losing control of my bowels," he said. "Oh, my God, it's documented." Later, after his story had gone public, Jack, Joel, and Brenda all tried to track down the picture through phone calls and public record requests, but the photo never turned up. Officials at Sandia also looked on my behalf, but never found it. Meanwhile, after our last conversation, Jack's case languished. I'd search for news about him from time to time, but nothing new showed up. Then last year, I came across a press release about Jack from the lawyers representing him. In February 2020, the final decision was rendered, granting Dr. Revell his benefits, it said. It had taken 4 years of work, but Jack had won. The release went through the process and details of the case, but only in the second-to-last paragraph did it say what happened to Jack. Unfortunately, Dr. Revell passed away on January 26, 2020, just 3 weeks before the decision was rendered. In January, Jack's widow, Brenda, talked to me on the phone from her home in Southern California, relating what had happened in her thick British accent. Even after his death, it still took a sternly worded letter from Brenda for the VA to start paying his benefits. Jack got weaker and weaker during his final days. At a car show, Brenda needed to hold him up by the shoulders. He'd fall more often, once hitting his head, hard. After Brenda and Jack's daughter Karen realized they could no longer care for him, he was taken to an assisted living facility. On January 26, 2020, a caretaker came into his room. "Good morning, Jack," she said. She got no response. He died in his sleep. For most of his life, Jack lived with secrets that he could tell no one. In the early days, he didn't get the respect he deserved, Brenda says. Being able to talk about what he'd done 50 years after he'd done it lifted a great weight off his shoulders. It was a relief, she says. It gave him a second lease on life. This was adapted from a story that first appeared in ncrabbithole.com. And we'll move on to the Talking Points page, starting with Murdoch. Privilege succumbs to justice. Justice was served, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. But Alex Murdoch's trial almost ended very differently. Last week, the South Carolina lawyer was convicted of murdering his wife and 22-year-old son, Paul, and sentenced to life in prison. It was the longest criminal trial in South Carolina history, riveting the country and marking the end of the nearly 100-year legal reign of the Murdoch family in the state's 14th Circuit. The family was mired in scandal. Murdoch stole millions from his clients. Paul was charged with drunkenly causing the accidental death of a 19-year-old girl in a boat crash. And after a housekeeper died on the family property, Murdoch stole her family's $4.3 million insurance payout. The jury reached a verdict in under 3 hours, but he might have gotten off but for two critical turning points. The first was a video taken by Paul moments before his death, proving that Murdoch lied about leaving the murder scene. The second was the dismissal of a juror who allegedly told people he's not guilty. Otherwise, there might have been a hung jury. Millions of Americans followed the trial, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon, and not just because of the crime's lurid nature. The case resonated because white male privilege was on trial, along with the defendant Murdoch himself testified and tried to bullshit his way out of the obvious guilt. In a cinematic turn, the trial was presided over by Judge Clifton Newman, a black son of domestic worker, who told Murdoch at sentencing that for the rest of his life, you have to see Paul and Maggie when you're attempting to go to sleep. What a come down for a man whose family had dominated Murdoch country, going back to his great-grandfather, said Emma Brox in The Guardian. Murdoch is the embodiment of what happens when people are cushioned over generations from the consequences of their own actions. His conviction also signals the end of an era, said David Lauderdale in the Charlotte Observer. The trial provided one of the harshest looks at the ills of humankind that will ever seep out of the South Carolina Lowcountry. Everyone believed the family was untouchable, but when the guilty verdicts were read and the handcuffs clicked on Murdoch's wrist, it proved that no one is above the law. Reverse racism. Are whites the real victims? Dilbert cartoonist Scott Adams argues that black people are the real racists, said Lucian K. Truscott IV in Salon, and an alarming number of white people seem to agree. In a recent YouTube rant calling for resegregating society, Adams, 65, claimed he had proof of so-called reverse racism. Just 53% of black respondents to a recent poll agreed with a statement popularized by far-right extremists on the 4chan internet group. It's okay to be white. The reluctance of black people to endorse this statement makes them a hate group, Adams said, urging his fellow whites to just get the hell away. Hundreds of newspapers responded by dropping Adams' once popular workplace satire, but Adams is hardly alone in claiming that white people are the victims of racism, not black people. That sentiment got Donald Trump elected president in 2016 and fills Fox News airwaves every day. Adams has exposed America's bizarre double standard on the subject of race, said Wilford Riley in National Review. Imagine that a witty black cartoonist said most American whites are at least a bit racist, and so black folks have no choice but to view whites as dangerous. There would be no outcry, indeed. It's now commonplace for hip progressive journalists to accuse whites en bloc of being violent threats. If Americans really want to have an honest conversation about race, we should discuss the fact that federal statistics show that of the roughly 600,000 documented violent crimes in the U.S. involving blacks and white, 90% involved a black perp and a white victim. That should be fair game. It's also fair game to discuss why most black people are still stuck in impoverished neighborhoods, said Charles M. Blow in the New York Times. In recent years, statistics show white flight has left 80% of major metropolitan regions more segregated as of 2019 than they were in 1990. As a result, black school kids attend underfunded urban schools and have a much lower chance of going to college. And even when they do, their white peers accumulate an average of 7 times more wealth. The continuing reality of actual racism never penetrates the right-wing echo chamber, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. There, the consequences Adams is suffering only reinforce the white victimhood narrative. He's another white man punished for his views. And we have time for a few of the short notes. New York City is now spending nearly $5 million a day to house and feed migrants, including tens of thousands who were bused there from the border by the Republican governors of Texas and Arizona. Caring for migrants will cost the city some $4.2 billion in this next fiscal year and the next, said Mayor Eric Adams in asking the White House for federal aid. The FBI issued a record 11,500 seizure orders for guns bought by people who later flunked background checks in 2020 and 2021. A huge surge in gun buying during the pandemic created long delays in background checks, and under the law, licensed dealers can go ahead with weapon sales if the checks are not completed within 3 days. Carbon dioxide emissions reached a record high of 36.8 gigatons last year. The rebound of air travel and driving from a pandemic lull and a growth in coal-fueled power plants helped drive a 1% increase over 2021. But a boom in renewable energy and electrical vehicles largely offset the greater use of fossil fuels. At least 14 states have introduced various proposals this year to restore voting rights to convicted felons, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. More than 4.6 million Americans are currently unable to vote because of felony convictions. On the poll watch, a record high 51% of Americans, including 72% of Republicans and 42% of Democrats, now believe the coronavirus leaked from a Chinese lab. Just 18% believe the virus was transmitted from animals to humans, while 31% remain undecided. 28% of Democrats believe the pandemic had natural origins, down 11 points from late February. Meanwhile, just 8% of Republicans believe the natural transmission theory, representing a 6-point drop. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from Iris Murdoch, who says, "Virtue is the attempt to pierce the veil of selfish consciousness and join the world as it really is." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.